Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important, the fastest growing, and now the largest segment of society. To those of you who, like me, have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they have become counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Over the next 3 hours, you're welcome to join this program and discuss these issues along with us. Our number is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Quite honestly, I'm wearing thin on the Ferguson issue. But I did listen to a blog presentation with some interesting evidence presented therein. This morning it was sent to me by a listener to this program. And any time that there is a chance that I may have said something material that could be wrong, I always like to double back and clear the air. And there's a possibility that that is the case. One of the things that I noticed when I was looking at the diagram that by Baden showing the entry and exit wounds of the what he says were six or more shots is that some aspects of it make absolutely total sense. When you fire a handgun like this, the gun rises, you've got a shot to the thumb, then forearm, and then a bicep, and then armpit, and then you have a victim that appears to be falling, and a shot with the head bent down that grazes the eye, chin, and then collarbone, with the last shot being to the top of the head. That would all make perfect sense with a with Brown moving towards, even running towards Wilson, the cop. The only problem was the drawing of an exit wound above the right nipple. That's not possible to have an exit wound from a shot that he links by dots from the armpit through the right nipple as the exit place if, in fact, he was running towards the officer. I can't even think of a convoluted position that would enable that to take place. But it's a very crude drawing, and the circles on the drawing are very crudely rendered, and the positioning of the body is awkward with the laying face up, standing face up with the palms facing forward. It's just an extraordinarily odd position that's just not the least bit telling, revealing. So if we think for a moment that the wound above the right nipple may have been either a seventh shot that grazed the victim, or that the armpit shot was wrongly positioned on the drawing just because of the nature of the drawing. It's very difficult to tell where the actual location was, but such that the right arm was you know, stretching forward as you would stretch if you were running towards someone, and therefore crossed the body as arms do when you're running, pushing forward, stretching forward under those circumstances. Then it's quite possible that he was, in fact, not running away, but running forward. Then everything makes sense, including Baden's description that the shots were fired while while Brown was moving towards Wilson, not away from him. Now, why would that be important?
Well, hold on a second here. We have another set of information that disputes that. He doesn't have any gunpowder residue on him. Where would that be?
Okay. Not okay. It doesn't dispute it. Let me tell you let me give you a scenario that I heard. Two bits of evidence. One is hearsay. One is not under oath, but both bits of evidence are telling. The best friend of Wilson's fiance did speak and did communicate to journalists what Wilson said occurred, because Wilson's report has not been released. I think that is a horrible miscarriage of justice, but it's part of our justice system that needs to be revamped in these kind of cases. Information needs to be released so people know the truth, so that they're not making stupid statements and inspiring people to riot. but his fiance's best friend explained it, that according to Wilson, this is what occurred. Now, so this is hearsay, but I'm going to give you in a moment a non-hearsay witness that says the same thing. That what happened is that Wilson did pass Brown and Johnson walking in the middle of the street. And that he asked them to get out of the middle of the street and go to the sidewalk, and they were confrontational, hurling insults at the officer. The officer then either received the dispatch call talking about the convenience store robbery and the description of the suspects and the cigars that were stolen, and or he just happened to see, to notice that these guys matched that description. And he went back not because they were jaywalking, walking in the middle of the street, but because they matched the description. And even the police chief, when he first gave his account, well, he said that, that at that point, Wilson was unaware of the robbery. He, within hours of that time, corrected his own testimony and said that's not correct. He was aware. And he did get the report, which also matches other police reports that have been made public. He went back to question him. Now, at that point, the smart thing, of course, would have been to call the backup, but he didn't do that. At that point, according to the testimony of Wilson's fiancé's best friend, so this is hearsay, mind you, we have not read Wilson's report, that he tried to get out of the car, the cop did, and that Brown, who is very intimidating, we've seen being a pusher, because what he did in the convenience store, shoved the car door back, preventing the officer from getting out of the car, violently pushing him back in. Then he continued to walk, and so the officer was able to get out of the car, at which time there was a confrontation, and according to several reports, the officer was treated for facial injuries. He was struck in the face by Brown's fist, according to those reports. There was a physical altercation, and that there will be medical reports that will show the wounds that he was treated for. Not critical, but the wounds that he was treated for. That will be an important bit of evidence if it is confirmed. At that point, the hearsay evidence is that Brown, after hitting Wilson, reached for his gun. A struggle ensued further, and ultimately Brown ran away. The officer then pulled his gun and said, "Halt, freeze." Then Brown turned around and mocked him and said, "What are you going to do, shoot me?" And continued to move away. And the officer yelled again, "Freeze," at which time, according to this hearsay, Brown turned and charged the officer and was running towards him. Now, everything except the location of a potential exit wound in the right nipple fits that scenario. And that the officer began shooting, and then the last shots were fired when Brown was about 10 to 15 feet away, coming towards the officer. That being the case, if it is the case, then you would not have had gunpowder residue on Brown, and the shooting would have been completely legal, and in fact been appropriate under those circumstances. The video that I shared with you that was so laughable, in the because the person shooting the video of Brown's body laying in the street. Evidently in that video, and I have not re-listened to it, but I am told that in the background you can hear a woman who was an eyewitness describe what occurred. And what she says is identical to what I have just shared. Identical in every detail. Now, if that's the case, then all we've got is an awkward drawing and a potential exit wound that's not an exit wound, or poor positioning of an entry and exit wound based upon a very crude drawing. And the rest of it makes sense. Now, all that being the case, if it is in fact the case, what I'd like to share is one other thing, and then we're going to talk about the important part of Ferguson. Brown has been positioned as a gentle giant who was an unarmed individual, who was a good boy, you know, making his way from high school, which he graduated as a wonderful example, off to college. Most of that's not true. Brown was a self-styled rap artist, and he has many posted songs and lyrics which are revolting. Can't share them on this program. Can't share them on any radio program. They are violent. They are humiliating. They are disgusting. His favorite links on his website are to street fights, in particular men beating up women. He was talked giddily about getting high with drugs and about violently beating up and putting in coffins anybody who tried to stop him from his sexual conquests and his stealing and his what he viewed as murderous activity. Now, beyond that, this boy, young man, we now know that he had marijuana in his system, but to the degree, to the significance, we don't know, but he would have had to have had his judgment impaired. A person who is capable of thinking rationally does not go into a convenience store without a hoodie, without a mask, in front of known cameras in multiple positions, and as every convenience store has, and steal a box of cigars. They don't intimidate the store owner without any disguise, looking directly into the camera. You don't do that exercising good judgment. If you do steal, you don't walk down the middle of the street trying to draw attention to yourself. That's stupid. And if you are confronted by a cop, you don't strike him, particularly in these circumstances. And if, in fact, he was running towards Wilson, that was also very poor judgment, and it led to his death. There are 7 takeaways from what is occurring and has occurred in Ferguson, Missouri, heartland of America. And that is really all that matters. The first is that we have grotesquely overarmed police. They should have means of deterrence, not deadly weapons. The deadly weapons should be a last resort, and they should, their mindset should be, if I have to deploy a deadly weapon in an urban setting, that my first choice ought to be to flee and come at this with more people in a better situation on another day. If that officer was carrying and deployed a stun gun instead of a pistol, if he was carrying one of those pepper spray pistols, which are spectacular in terms of their accuracy, their range, and their effectiveness in stopping a situation like this, we would have had an absolute perfect result. But because he was carrying a deadly weapon, a man is dead for a series of bad decisions. That's first. We need to demilitarize our police in that scenario in terms of the weapons. But what's happened, particularly under the Obama administration, as we've wound down the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, hundreds of thousands of military weapons have been given to police, from flak jackets to night vision goggles to assault rifles to armored personnel carriers to attack helicopters. We have gone in the wrong direction at an extraordinarily rapid pace that is a extremely large problem for this country. Second is attitude. The attitude that's displayed by those who fight America's wars of dehumanizing the enemy and being confrontational is the same attitude now that's on display way too often with police. we need to stop hiring vets, combat vets in particular, to be police. It's interesting. I was having a conversation with someone who will go unnamed about someone who is quite close to and has reason to know the motivation for a preponderance of those who engage in U.S. military. And this particular individual told me yesterday that, to a man, they all said that they had chosen to enlist in the military because they wanted to go shoot people. That the mentality was, I get to go hunting, but this time to prey is people. And I get to fire the best weapons in doing so. That mentality does not work in a police force. I don't think that mentality works in a soldier. But it most certainly doesn't work in a police force. The attitude is wrong. That's the second point. We have to change our attitude of law enforcement. And radically. Not racial attitude. Just attitude. Rather than escalating problems, how to ask people to do things in such a way that it's not insulting, that it's not threatening. Next is, we have a real problem of lack of disclosure. We don't have a justice system in this country. We have a legal system, and it is badly crippled. And to that regard, the point that I made yesterday is important. If you're going to carry a gun, if you're going to work for the feds, for a state, for a city, and you're involved in an altercation of this kind, there ought to be full disclosure, and quickly. And none of this, well, you know, we'll release the police report later, and, you know, the officer's entitled to his privacy and all that sort of thing. No. Put out the information. Let people ponder it. The next, of course, point four, is after we leave lack of disclosure, is the militarization of America. It's not just the equipment that's in the police cars. It's not just the equipment they give to police. It's that the police response now is to show up looking like the military, full of, even wearing military-type helmets, military flak jackets, military assault rifles, military armored personnel carriers. They're shooting grenade launchers full of tear gas. You can't even tell the difference anymore between the SWAT teams of police and the National Guard and federal agents. They all look the same. Way too many of them. Way too well, too heavily armed. Way too pervasive in our society. We ought not be a police state. This is causing vastly more problems than it is resolving. Now, there are three more issues, and we will talk about them. The consequence of poor judgment, the war on drugs, and the entitlement mentality and its consequences. We're reviewing the seven takeaways, the seven lessons we can learn from Ferguson. The first was that we need to remove the guns from the holsters of police officers across America. And we need to replace them with the pepper guns and with stun guns, and that the pistol ought to be available, but not on the body of the officer, and should not be even possible for someone who doesn't know the release code of that gun, or doesn't have the matching palm ingredients to fire that pistol, to even have access to it. So we completely eliminate all of the deaths of individuals who the officer claimed was trying to reach for their gun. We need deterrence, not deadly weapons, not deadly force. Number two, we need an entire attitude adjustment regarding our military and regarding our police, so that they de-escalate a situation rather than their belligerence. Their attitude is causing a huge problem in this country. Number three, we have to move to full disclosure. I really am irritated when somebody says, you know, you're just speculating that, you know, it'll all come out in trial and we'll know the facts. Oh, good grief. It's like people have absolutely no clue what the legal system in this country is all about. and what is admissible and what's not admissible, and the fact that there really is no difference. Evidence is evidence. And in a court, one lawyer is going to try to position it one way, the other lawyer is going to try to position it the other way. There is no difference in you and I looking at evidence and lawyers trying to spin evidence in terms of coming up with a conclusion. And juries are more likely to come up with a, this is the truth, than is any informed and rational person looking at the evidence available. As a matter of fact, there's always more evidence available to those who are not part of the jury system because the criminal justice system prohibits so much evidence. So don't pretend that there's a difference. The evidence is the evidence. Release it. Let people know to the greatest degree possible the various perspectives on what occurred. We need disclosure. That's true about everything in our society. We don't ever talk about the facts. It's like we have a war on terrorism and no one wants to talk about Islam, the motivation for terrorism. We need disclosure. You can't exercise good judgment unless you have access to information. And we are foreclosing information. The next is a huge problem. This is the problem that I began to discuss 5 or 6 years ago. And now it has made the front page of virtually every periodical in the nation. New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, NBC, you name it. Everyone has now done a story on this, but they'll soon forget it and go on to their next story. It is literally amongst the top 5 or 6 most critical aspects of the death of this country, which is the militarization of the United States. Not only with the largest military in the world, but also with a plethora of federal agents from FBI to CIA to ATF to Department of Homeland Security and Customs Police and on and on and on it goes. And then you have to add to that all of the state police, local police, the sheriff.
There's another thing that we lead the world in, other than military.
Prison population.
Prison population.
Yeah.
By far.
By far. By far. I mean, no nation anywhere close to us in percentage of our population or total numbers in prison as the United States. We are the world's prison state. We are the world's dominant military, larger than every other military combined. We have become what America once despised. The next issue is poor judgment. This is a direct legacy of political correctness becoming the national religion in America, where you are so limited on what you can discuss. Like, you can't even openly discuss homosexuality in this country without being publicly crucified. You can't publicly discuss the root cause of terrorism, which in 99.9% of the cases is fundamentalist Islam. Not extremist, not radical, but fundamentalist. We have precluded people even discussing the truth, and then in political correctness, exercising good judgment is the ultimate crime, being judgmental. Because you're supposed to be tolerant and accepting of mutually exclusive ideas, which is ludicrous. Making poor judgments is what led to Michael Brown's death. If he had not robbed the liquor store, if he had not been filmed doing so, then gloating, walking down the middle of the street, carrying his stogies, and if he hadn't responded aggressively to the cop, he wouldn't be dead. Bad judgment. When he posted all of those songs, those rap songs that were so murderous and so sexist and so revolting online, he showed so many pictures of himself flipping the bird, poor judgment. It's just poor judgment. When he assaulted the clerk of that store, the owner of the store, poor judgment. But when Al Sharpton makes this a racial issue, poor judgment. When people believe him and start rioting as the response, poor judgment. Our inability to exercise good judgment, to be moral, to be civil, to be rational as a people, is, I think, the single most aggravating cause of America's decline. It's the reason why I tell everyone who listens to this program that America's problems, the world's problems, cannot be fixed. And the reason they can't be fixed is that we have so dumbed down most people to the point where they're incapable of processing information in a rational way. And therefore, they can't make an informed, logical conclusion. And as such, no amount of information is going to do them any good. Even if we could solve the problem of too little important information, and we could open up the debate where people were properly informed, they still can't think. They react. That's the single biggest problem. Here in America, for generations now, we've imposed political correctness as part of the academic curriculum, and no one is thinking. No one is exercising good judgment. This is the problem that led to Michael Brown's death. It is the problem that's led to the jaundiced reporting of him being a gentle giant and that he was an unarmed teenager and therefore a victim. It is the reason that this has been twisted into a racial divide when there is no racial aspect of it at all, only in the response, not in the act. It's why there are riots. We lack judgment as a nation. And without exercising good judgment, there is no hope. An individual cannot be helped if they're incapable of exercising good judgment. Point six on my list of seven takeaways is that indirectly, this mess is a direct result of a foolish and failed war on drugs. First of all, we should never have declared a war on drugs. They should have been legal from the beginning. Legal and discouraged is the way that drugs should be. That being the case, you wouldn't have the illegal immigration problem you have in this country, particularly people roaring in from places like Honduras and places where the in-betweens of the drug flow from South America to feed America's appetite. You wouldn't have the horrendous murders in Mexico, all to control the drug market to satiate America's appetite. If drugs were legal, there wouldn't be street gangs that draw the young people in, particularly in minority communities, and get them into the gang mentality and gang banging and carrying guns and perpetrating such heinous crimes, making their communities economic death zones because no one in their right mind wants to go into a community that's ravaged by these drug gangs. And it's drugs that fuels these gangs. The war on drugs has led to egregious poverty, to the immersion of great catastrophe through gang mentality, to death, to carnage, to all manner of just disaster. It needs to be ended. You know, the fact is it didn't work. Not only did we spend a fortune on it, not only did we get to the point where our prisons are overcrowded and we're a prison state, not only did we get to the point where our justice system can't function because it's overcrowded, not only are we bankrupt because we can't afford all the prosecution, much less the incarceration, not only did it turn inner cities into war zones, but the amount and the quality of drugs has never been greater in America. It has failed in its entirety. We need to legalize all drugs and then discourage them. Lastly, the entitlement mentality in America is devastating. When Lyndon Johnson proposed the Great Society and welfare, and then following that was food stamps, and when we went to the mentality that you're entitled to Cadillac health care, even if you don't pay for it, even if you're irresponsible in terms of your health, that you're entitled to subsidized housing, that you're entitled to food from the government, that you're entitled to be financed by the government for doing nothing. We destroy character. We destroy ambition. We destroy personal responsibility. We create the mentality that I don't need to pay for those cheap cigars. I'll just go five-finger discount them. There is a direct consequence to what it does to a person's character when we create an entitlement state. It is a disaster. It has bankrupt America, not just financially, but morally. Those are the seven takeaways of Ferguson. In other news, something terrible, something tragic, something extraordinarily common occurred yesterday, and it has the world up in arms. A journalist was beheaded by a fundamentalist Muslim. We'll talk about that story. I have two different articles regarding what occurred and the reaction of various people, as well as what was stated in the video. And we'll discuss it when Chattering Myths continues after the commercial break. Welcome back to Chattering Myths. A listener to the program corrected me on something, and before we move on to the next story, I do want to comment on it. I said, hi, Craig. He says, those pistols that you're talking about that only work with a particular individual, they have a receiver that's embedded in the handle of the gun, and then the user wears a ring or a bracelet that's keyed to the chip in the handle. It's a really good design. So it's not a palm kind of thing, but it isn't. And it makes a lot more sense that the gun has a receiver. You wear something on your wrist or hand that's keyed to it, and the gun doesn't operate unless the person wearing that is holding the gun. And so it means that if a Brown were to have tried to get the gun away from the officer, he could not have fired it. It would not have worked, but the technology is a little different than I reported. All right, that being the case, the news is the Islamic State, this says militant group, I don't know if they're a militant group, the Islamic State is a religious group, I'll go along with that, that is comprised of mujahideen, holy warriors, so that would be a more complete description. In fact, if you want to have a complete description, you'd have to be redundant. The Islamic State is an Islamic religious group engaged in jihadist activities. Claimed Tuesday to have beheaded an American photojournalist in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes in Iraq. Yeah, cause and consequence. That is cause and consequence, my friends. The video, and that's what I've said, you know, if by America bombing Iraq to protect the Zoroastrians, that the consequence in America would be grievous. Welcome to reality. You know, we broke Iraq by bombing Iraq. You're not going to fix Iraq by bombing Iraq again. It's our invasion of Iraq that led to the Syrian civil war, and it's that Syrian civil war that we began to arm the Islamic State, which at the time was the Islamic State in Iraq, which became the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. You know, that's how we created this mess. You don't solve the mess by repeating what you did that created the mess. A video posted on YouTube, later removed. Oh, yes, because we don't want America to see the truth. Yet, why is it removed? You know, when people have the opportunity to see the viciousness of this religion, then they will come to it either understand that the religion cannot be tolerated, that the religion is evil, or they will do as I did one time in my life, where I went off and said, you know, anything this menacing that would fly planes into buildings and kill 3,000 people, think they're doing a service for their God, anything that menacing, I need to know about. And by seeing those videos, maybe more people would say, I need to know about that. I need to understand it. I need to stop believing that good Muslims are peaceful and only bad extremist Muslims are ruthless. We need to show people the hideousness of it. Don't disclose, I mean, don't remove that which is essential. You know, one of the things about violence, and I know this is counterintuitive, but it is very real. And that's why this beheading and seeing it and listening to it is so essential. And why it should not be removed. And why I'm so angry with the media and with politicians for removing such things. I'm even if the family wanted it removed, it ought not be. Make the man's life count for something by motivating others to drop their ignorance of Islam. And to come to understand the mentality of someone that would cut off another man's head as a service to his God. A man that whose only crime is that he was carrying a camera and was purported to be an American. What the issue here is that if I tell you that there were 1.2 million Christians in Iraq prior to America's invasion, their life wasn't great, but they were able to live in relative peace. And that after America's invasion, the number of Christians fell to a couple of hundred thousand, even while America was there, because they were hunted down, because their churches and homes were burned. Then if I were to tell you that once America left, the 200,000 that remained dwindled to about 60,000 when the Shiites and Sunnis began to take aim at them. And then if I were to tell you that when the Islamic State arose, that 60,000 went to zero.